welcome to another cigar stream. We're here for Dark Lord Watch. And it's actually a bit of a double bill feature tonight, because not only do we have Tone coming from the World Economic Forum, where he and his friends have been making dark plans for us all, but also I have an interesting interview that he did with the current Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, in 2021. Now, the reason that is interesting is because, if you remember, Jeremy Hunt was not in government in 2021, and now he is. And not only is he in government, but he was kind of parachuted in out of nowhere when Liz Truss was brought down. Do you remember? Do you remember when they installed Jeremy Hunt, the regime? They installed Hunt as the Chancellor, completely undermining Liz Truss's authority, and then she had to resign. And then they parachuted in Rishi Sunak. Do you remember that? That was only a couple of months ago. While at the same time, Keir Starmer's Labour are literally paying the Dark Lord to give his shadow cabinet lessons. I mean, I'm not even making this up. Blair is giving the Labour cabinet lessons, while at the same time, Jeremy Hunt, and when we watch this interview, you'll see just how close Hunt and Blair are. The question has to be asked, why was Jeremy Hunt talking to Blair at all in 2021? Blair is a Labour man. Hunt is a Conservative. So, well, you all know why. Anyway, before we get going, I'll just remind people to pay the bills, keep the lights on here, do buy courses at the academic agency, join the channel, subscribe to my Substack, and thank you for all of your support. But let us waste no time, because there's a lot to get through, and there's only so much time. So I'm going to make the screen big so we can watch Tony. And I have to say, as this starts, right, it's just the first 10 seconds or so, Blair looks like he is haunted and riddled by evil at this point. He can't even raise a smile as he's introduced. Watch it. In fact, I'm going to make you watch it a number of times just to see what evil does to a person. Watch this now. Watch this.
The Right Honourable Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of the UK, founder of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. We're delighted to have Honourable Tony Lamy.
What's he thinking about? That is so haunting. That I've got it on speed dial here. I'm going to play it again.
The Right Honourable Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of the UK, founder of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. We're delighted to have.
I mean, it's amazing. I'm going to play it again, a third time. I really can't get enough of this. What's he thinking? I mean, to me, it reminds me of the end of Godfather 2. You know, he's just killed his brother. He's sitting on, spoilers, sorry, but if you haven't watched Godfather 2, just get out. But anyway, he's just killed Fredo. You know, he's alienated his wife. Everybody his dad is gone. His older brother, Sonny, is gone. You know, he's alienated Tom Hagen. Anybody he's trusted is long gone. You know, and he's just sitting on his own on the park bench. He's all powerful. He's killed all of the other family bosses. But there's a kind of emptiness at the heart of it. Power, absolute power, corrupts absolutely. And just as you're watching the Dark Lord here, as his, you know, his list of accomplishments and his former Prime Minister, head of the Tony Blair Institute, is reeled out, there's not even a flicker of fucking there's not even a flicker of human recognition in these eyes here. It's just amazing. Let's watch it again.
The Right Honourable Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of the UK, founder of the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change.
What's going through his mind? What's he thinking about? Think of all the kind of evil that is lurking. Like, is there the kind of memory of the man that was in those eyes?
We're delighted to have Honorable Tony. Let me ask you. You've sat in a chair very similar to Helen's. I'm interested in your perspectives on maintaining political focus as well.
Yeah, well, the best way to maintain political focus, because I mean the reality is for the political debate in many, many countries now, COVID is in the rearview mirror. I mean, it isn't, but believe me, most the people sitting in Downing Street at the moment are not talking about COVID. Do you
remember I keep on saying it's a politically dead issue? Blair knows. It's in the rearview mirror, he said. Right. And what he's saying is that our plans have been scuppered, lads. We have to face the reality that what we wanted to do has been, it's on the back burner right now. So how are we going to find a way to get through the shit we want, i.e. digital IDs, i.e. get them back on the train of taking inoculations and shots and whatnot? How do we salvage the kind of total healthcare state that we were trying to set up during COVID? We have been dealt a blow by the bloody inconvenience of politics. How rude of politics to get involved with our plans. Isn't that right, Tony?
And at the G7 and the G20, I think you won't get the focus you need.
Yes, a lot of people have noticed his weird shoes. Now, if I was like Charlie Ward or Simon Parks or whatever, do you remember that whole thing doing like Copium Den, where they'd say like, "Oh, look at those shoes McCain is wearing. Look at those weird shoes Hillary's wearing. That means they're slated to go to Guantanamo Bay." Do you remember all that sort of stuff? Did make me think of that, but it's probably, probably it's nothing to do with all of that. But it is a bit weird that he's wearing these big bloody loafers. But well, they're like Doc Martens or something. Anyway, let's carry on.
Unless it's clear, two things. One, that there is an ongoing challenge and opportunity. And I think that is not just about COVID. It's about the fact that we are going to have a whole slew of new vaccines injected.
By the way, just on the mention of Alien Man and what I like to call the kook sphere, I got a message today from AAA school basically saying that the government have turned on the emergency messaging system. And that was always one of their big talking points is like, oh, the EMS, the emergency messaging system is going to come. Well, we got the message today that the government has turned on the emergency messaging system and they're now putting out what to expect when you get an emergency message. So, maybe Alien Man was right all along, but I doubt it somehow. He's gone a bit quiet recently, hasn't he? But yeah. Anyway, that is true because I got it from my. Yes, I mean I can show you if you want. The I put it on Twitter earlier on. This emergency messaging system. Let me just find it for you. This was the kind of note we received. This is literally from AAA school, and I'm guessing anyone who's a parent would have had this from their kid's school today. It was like, "Dear parent, message from the Department of Education. The government is set to roll out new emergency alarm alert system, which will send alerts to mobile phones when there is a danger to life in the area you are located. It is expected to launch this year with all compatible 4G and 5G." Speaking of Alien Man, 5G. make sure you get your kind of what do they call it? The 5G helmet or whatever it was, the USB protection device or whatever he was selling. But in England, receiving a welcome message. If you get an emergency alert on your mobile phone or 4G, 5G device, you hear a loud siren-like sound. A message on your screen will then tell you about the emergency and how best to respond. You'll be able to check online if an alert is genuine. Please read the new emergency guidance and review your risk assessments and emergency plans to include relevant processes should an emergency alert be issued in your area. Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Dun, dun, dun. So, yes, I just thought that was a kind of a little bit interesting that that was one of their big talking points, that this was coming down the pike. And there it is, you know. So I'm not encouraging anybody to go back to the kook sphere, of course, but it's kind of strange. All right, back to tone.
That are going to deal with some of the worst diseases in the world, that give us the opportunity to make big changes in the health of the world. And if you want the politicians to focus, they need to think, look, this is coming down the track soon, because if you tell them about a future pandemic, they'll kind of go, yeah, no, maybe someone else's problem. But you tell them, actually, in the next few years, you're going to have the opportunity to make a big difference to the healthcare of your population. That will focus them. But the second thing they need is to focus on the opportunities to change healthcare that have arisen as a result of our experience of COVID. Because, you know, when all said and done, it was still a pretty remarkable operation. And by the way, you know, CEPI did a fantastic job. You guys deserve a lot of congratulations.
Well done, guys. Well done. Good operation. I mean, the things we got out of it were good. You know, we didn't quite get all the things we wanted, but the things we've got were, you know, great opportunity. That's a pat on the back, everybody. All right, how do we sell this to the stupid governments around the world?
For it, but so I think it's around things like, how do you make sure you get the right scientific cooperation and the cooperation between the regulatory authorities, so in the future you can clear things much faster? For example,
how do you get the right science? I mean, in other words, how do we stop all those idiot doctors who were raising questions about the data? How do we stop Robert Malone being a thing? How do we stop, like, people asking irritating questions about, you know, whether these big pharma companies had been through all the right checks and so on and so forth? How can we, like, clear the path to get rid of bloody all that irritating regulation and red tape that I probably set up myself back in the late 90s? You know, for shit that, you know, when we want it done, how do we get rid of all of that? Yeah, good question, Tone. Good question.
For example, on the continent of Africa, if we had an equivalent to the European Medicines Agency, we had an African Medicines Agency that allowed you to have one system, one standard, which hugely changed the way that vaccines and treatments are introduced in Africa.
That's one of the things that Tony is very pissed off about. I think the take-up rate for the vax in Africa was only 6%. And of course, that concerns Tony greatly because, as he never tires of telling people, he has 480 million people under his direct remit in Africa alone. There was a clip of him where he let slip. He said, oh, you know, my presidents, that's what he said, my presidents, my African presidents. Yeah, 480 million people have the benefit of the direct advice of Sir Tone himself, you know, sitting next to, you know, all those clips of him with various African leaders. I mean, that's how Tony Blair has to get a lot of its money, through government contracts of that nature. And what Tony wants to do, he wants to make like a kind of an African version of the EU, so that next time they get proper compliance in that region. Because it's probably why he's looking so grave at the start. He's like, plans didn't work in Africa. It's not good, not good at all.
I think that this issue of manufacturing, so a lot of countries learned that if they didn't have some recourse to manufacturing sovereignty, if you like, either directly or indirectly through partnerships with other countries, then they were at a disadvantage.
What was that phrase you just said? Manufacturing sovereignty. What did he say?
To manufacturing sovereignty, if you like.
Huh? Let's go back again.
equipments are introduced in Africa. I think that this issue of manufacturing, so a lot of countries learned that if they didn't have some recourse to manufacturing sovereignty, if you like, either directly or indirectly through partnerships with other countries, then they were at a disadvantage. I think there's a huge impetus now for a national digital infrastructure.
National digital infrastructure. Here we go.
Digitization in healthcare is, I think, one of the great game changers. You know, we should be helping countries to develop a national digital infrastructure, which they will need with these new vaccines. And then,
you know, he's not just that happy with the UK. You know, he doesn't just want it for the UK. He wants it for every country. National digital infrastructure. You know, we need to roll this out for everybody. Doesn't matter if you live in the bloody Congo or in Chad or in, you know, Central African Republic or in Netherlands or in the UK. This is coming down the pike because these fuckers want it.
And, you know, finally, it's also about showing people and showing the political leadership that you can make a positive difference to your healthcare system by adopting these measures, because they've got an impact beyond any particular disease and or pandemic. So I think if you want to keep the political focus, and I agree it's vital that you do, you've got to show people that this is a continuing issue, right? It's not a future issue, it's here and now. It's got a broad set of implications, and there are a set of solutions that COVID has taught us, arising out of the challenges of COVID, to which, if we apply the right political will,
power,
we can make our healthcare systems better, not just for pandemic and disease, but more generally for the health of the population. If you do that, they'll think there are votes in it, and, you know, if there are votes in it, they'll they'll focus.
He's got his mojo back now. I mean, he's basically saying that sell the government the political technology. You know, so use COVID. You can use what happened with COVID and the prospect of future pandemics to sell them this solution of national digital ID as a political technology that governments could then sell to the nation as some, you know, security or something. And, you know, as he said, if they think there's votes in it, it'll be good. And what I would look out for is, in the UK, we know that the Tories are extremely unpopular at the moment, okay? So that means that we're pretty much certain to have a Labour government. So watch what Labour try to sneak into their manifesto. Just watch what Labour get up to when it comes to this. I mean, through previous Dark Lord watches, I have always said that I think Labour will try to use immigration and maybe even this issue of illegal immigration and the channel crossings as a way to smuggle in the digital ID, right? But just keep a little eye out for Labour on this. That's in the UK. In your country, if you're not from the UK, there'll be something similar coming down the pike because, you know, he said it. He basically wants it for every single country. And look, I mean, he was so grim at the start, and now look at this big Cheshire Cat grin is back. He's very happy with himself here. So let's carry on. Now, this was a panel. I've only cut out Blair's bits because it was like a 50-long-minute panel, and they were all like boring Germans and things on there. But I just wanted to fill it out, the Dark Lord's bit, so we can watch the Jeremy Hunt interview. So let's carry on.
Thank you. Tony, I want to switch gears slightly. You talked about the importance of linking the development of new countermeasures and capabilities to develop new countermeasures to ability and opportunities to deliver healthcare in the here and now, and that was critical to securing political buy-in. During the pandemic, we saw, as I said, there were multiple causes for the inequities of access that we saw. even after billions of doses of vaccine had been delivered, 12 billion doses in the first year, many countries encountered difficulties in delivering. And would be very interested in your thoughts, maybe the work of the Institute, on how to improve access to medicine so that if we can deliver vaccines in 100 days and other countermeasures in 100 days, how do we then get them to the people that need them?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. And
you can tell he's getting serious. Look, the steeple. Did you see it? Where was it? You can always tell. Look, there's the steeple hands. He's in his wheelhouse when the steeple hands come out.
So Albert was talking earlier about the politics of the situation. And I think there's sort of unforgivable politics and forgivable politics. The unforgivable politics is turning a public health issue into a political issue. I mean, I remember at the beginning of the onset of COVID, people saying, well, what do you think of the politics of COVID? How serious is this disease? And I was like, well, you asked me about the politics of the disease. I mean,
how dare people make it a political issue? Isn't that right, Tone? It's not a political issue. You will take what we say is best. It's a public health issue, isn't that right?
It's a disease. I don't know. You go and ask someone who knows. So what's unforgivable is turning things like whether you wear a face mask or not into a political issue. That is unforgivable.
Unforgivable. Absolutely unforgivable. If you think it's a political issue watching this, you are just a disgrace. This is beyond politics. Get the mask on, pleb. Tony wants you to wear a mask, you wear a mask. It's not a political issue.
And stupid. Right, but there's a
stupid.
Forgivable politics, which you see also, by the way, when it comes to Russia and Ukraine and energy prices.
The blades, the Blair blades have come out. The blade.
If you're a politician and you're facing an election and you've got the ability to vaccinate your people, you're going to vaccinate your people.
Look at that blade. I tell you, if he gave you a karate chop with that, he'd, you know. Right, what's the forgivable? So unforgivable politics was questioning whether to wear a mask, whether you want the government to inject you. That is unforgivable politics. Absolute stupidity. Not up for debate, says Tone. What's the forgivable politics?
People first, right. So how the question really is, how do you create a situation in which that more forgivable political anxiety is dealt with by a plan that allows you now to work on what are the elements you're going to need in order for this to be dealt with in the future equitably and properly? And
you see, what you have to understand here is that Blair is in the business of selling governments off-the-shelf solutions, okay, on behalf of his partner in crime, of course, William Fence. You know that Fence gives him millions, if not billions of dollars every year, okay? And we know that they basically make all that money back through government contracts with, I mean, God knows how much money they get from African governments and Middle Eastern governments and, you know, places like Kazakhstan and Albania, Tony is an advisor in. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, when it's all totted up, they're actually like, probably Fence gets like money back, I'd imagine, right? Now on the books, of course, all the money that Fence gives to Blair is chalked up as charity because the Tony Blair Institute is a charitable organization, believe it or not. It's a charity. So when they do the audit, it's like, oh, well, Bill Gates gave this much money to charity. Actually, he's giving it to Tony Blair in order to have the kind of leverage and the network to sell off-the-shelf solutions to governments. Okay, and they're not just selling it to African governments. They'll be selling it to European governments. They'll be, I mean, we have done dives before on how Tony Blair Institute white papers get turned into government policy. And the reason is, as I've explained many times, people in government are lazy, right? And they're stupid. I mean, we saw Liz Truss and bloody Kwarteng and these people. They don't bloody know what they're doing half the time. They don't have time. They're worried about the latest scandal. They're worried about what the media's saying. So it's like, well, oh shit, there's a crisis. So you can imagine like Kermit the Frog flapping his arms or that balloon in the wind, you know. And these guys turn up. They're organized. They're ready. They know what the solution is. Oh, by the way, government, have you considered this 300-page plan we've already got ready to go? And now what he's saying is, imagine something like COVID happened again. Well, we've got the ready-made solution, ready to roll, ready to go. And what you have to imagine happens at a place like Davos. But it's not just Davos, it is all around the world. But Blair never stops. I mean, we followed him for years now. You know, he'll go from here to Saudi Arabia. He'll go from Saudi Arabia to Italy. He'll go from Italy to New York. He never stops. He is always at events like this. It's not always World Economic Forum. It'll be some other thing, right? And it's not the meeting that you see here. It's the one that happens across the street off the books. That's where they'll be doing all their deals and so on. And there'll be world leaders or representatives of governments sitting and watching this. And they'll be saying like, hey, Tony, you mentioned, how can we be ready for a pandemic in the future? And you'd be like, oh, funny you asked that, because here's our solution right off the shelf. Would you like to buy our package? That'll be, you know, so many millions. Are you going to sign us up? And there it is. They're signed up now to the program. And you can see Blair's ideal vision is basically every country in the world doing the same thing. Every country in Africa, every country in Europe, every country in the Americas. And if he had his own way, over in the Far East as well. He wants everybody doing the same thing. Because ultimately, Blair is of the mind that things would be a lot simpler if we had a one world government. Okay, this is the nature of what these globalists are, right? Blair, as you've seen throughout this talk so far, sees local and domestic politics as a waste of bloody time, as an inconvenience, as almost like a kind of impertinence getting in the way of his plans. So he's like, well, all right, we got some things that we wanted, but there's more than one way to skin a cat. And this is what I'm saying. The Dark Lord never sleeps. He is always on it. Always on it. And he's just the one we watch. There'll be other people out there. Although increasingly, as there's talk of him taking over from Klaus Schwab at the WEF, increasingly I'm actually wondering if like Blair really is like getting close to Sauron at this point. But still, there'll be other operatives out there who do this sort of work as well. Although it does seem that Blair at this point has extraordinary powers. Anyway, let's carry on.
You know, I mean, I love listening to Albert because he's an expert that I can actually understand. And, you know, the thing that he's saying, I think, is so important just to alight on, which is that you've got to put the different elements of the players in this that are going to be important in making sure not just that a future pandemic is well handled, but that healthcare systems are developed properly. And as new treatments come online, then they're made available to more people. You've got to get the right people in a partnership together to work out how they create the mechanism so that in the future, it's better than it was in the past. And that is about getting the major pharmaceutical people, life science people, working with the regulators, with the governments understanding what it is they need to do.
You understand what he's saying here, right? Make sure that any bloody resistance is replaced with our guys. What went wrong with COVID is there were too many honest people in the system bodging things up and asking questions. We need to get rid of them. We need to make sure everybody's on board. Everybody is with the program. That's basically what he's saying here. We can't have a situation where you get some doctor with a conscience, or, you know, a government asking questions about Big Pharma, or they all need to be in bed together. That's what he's saying, right? In so many words. You always have to read between the lines with Tone, because he's good at trying to frame things in a way that makes him seem like he's trying to do the work of good. But that's really what he's saying. He's saying that we need to make sure that the regulator, Big Pharma, and governments are all on the same page, and we don't get this stupid situation where people are trying to take companies to court, people are asking questions, people are going on YouTube and, you know, bodging up the narrative. Message discipline, folks. So you just make sure you fire anyone who's not on board. That's basically what he's saying. It's like, for next time, we get this right. And we're going to do it this time on the, we're going to use COVID to project the fear of a future pandemic. And that's how we're going to do railroad through the next piece of the puzzle, which is ultimately this national digital infrastructure ID thing that he keeps on talking about.
In order to make sure that they're not left in a situation where they're scrabbling for vaccine or for equipment that they're going to need, but that there's going to be sufficient provision, and that there's going to be the ability to manufacture in countries in which there's not going to be the same problem. I think there's a there's going to be a move, I think, probably to set up manufacturing hubs, but in countries maybe that are small population countries, because if you're a manufacturing hub in a large population country, you're going to have to look after that population first. And I also think this issue to do with the technology and the digital infrastructure, I just want to emphasize how important I think that is, because
the digital infrastructure is the most important thing. You listen to this now, because ultimately all the other bullshit about masks and manufacturing, so he doesn't care about that. He cares about this. He cares exactly about the digital infrastructure, because that's the end goal.
In the end, you need the
power,
the data. You need to know who's been vaccinated and who hasn't been. Some of the vaccines that will come on down the line will be multiple. There'll be multiple shots. So you've got to have, for reasons to do with the healthcare more generally, but certainly for a pandemic or for.
I honestly think that when he starts thinking about the sheer power of it, he goes for the under, you know, the grasp move that he does underneath. That's him, like, power, I can feel it.
For vaccines, you've got to have a proper digital infrastructure, and many countries don't have that. In fact, most countries don't have that. So again, you've got to say, okay, who are the people that can make this happen? How do you get the right partnerships in place? So my view is, this is what I'm arguing with the that should happen in the G20 particularly, I think, which is, I mean, G7 is an important forum, but the G20 is the broader forum, is you've got to work out what is it that you want to achieve in order to make sure that any future pandemic is properly handled, and what are the partnerships that you're going to create in order to ensure that the answers you get are the right.
Can I just point out yet again the sheer brass neck on this guy, right? Bear in mind now that in theory, he's just the former Prime Minister of the UK. Yet in the space of about 8 minutes here, he has mapped out plans for not only like all of Africa, but now the entire G20 as well. I mean, the sheer brass neck on the guy. Just to be like openly laying out plans for multiple different countries, ignoring their domestic politics, basically kind of hand waving away anybody who has any other possible objections as quote stupidity, and now he's just talking about, you know, creating private public partnerships, quote, which basically means sweeping away enemies, like I said, in order to implement this plan across, you know, the 20 largest economies in the world, as well as all of Africa. Yeah, brilliant.
Right on.
And you know what? If I had to bet, they'll probably do this in like the next 10 years or something. Because, like, how can I put it? Everybody else is, and when I say everybody else, I don't mean like Blair's friend, like, what I mean is Blair and his friends there are really focused on this. They want this, okay? Everybody else is caught up in news cycles all the time. You know, they're on this one week, and then a couple of weeks later, they're onto something else. Now it's Trump and the FBI. Now it's fucking Kanye West. Now it's some other bullshit. Now it's something else. I mean, we all know it, right? People get bored. These guys, they're just thinking about this shit all the time. All 24/7. How can we make this happen? How can we? And don't forget, in Davos there, you've got the CEO of most major companies. You've got likes of Larry Fink. You've got most heads of government. They're all sitting in that room. And, you know, it's the organized minority. Even in a group like the World Economic Forum, yes, everybody goes there. It's just a conference, right? But within that setting, there is an organized minority even within that. And it's that organized minority, even within the kind of ruling class, that ultimately will get their way on a lot of this stuff. Right? I mean, you've heard him say, like, oh, COVID, yesterday's news. He said it at the start. But he's still focused on the prize. He's going to get it through one way or the other. And there's a few people in our spheres who have been onto this. Morgoth, I would always give credit for, has also really been on this digital ID thing that these guys want.
And then you're going to have the mechanisms of implementation. And those mechanisms will be partly through the formal institutions that you have, like the WTO, but they'll also be through organizations like yours, which I think, you know, have many advantages because they don't get landed with the same bureaucracy and, frankly, small p politics around them. So I think, you know, that...
Did you hear what he... Frankly, small p politics? You know, like how we talk about low politics? Tones like that as well, just from like the point of view of like sheer fucking evil, you know, small p politics, frankly, you know, just the absolute pain of domestic politics. We'll sweep that aside because we're making the plans in this room right now.
That's what we need to do. But if you want the politicians to focus on a plan, I promise you it's got to be because they think in the next few years, not in the broad future, it's going to matter to them to have that plan.
Can I just say how openly in this meeting Blair is talking about, right, if you want politicians to do this, we need to present it to them in this way. They're not even trying to hide it. They're basically saying, like, we need to steer governments and politicians to do the shit we want, right? And basically it's a matter of political will. And we are going to ramroad it through. Whether those politicians like it or not, we're going to basically persuade them. And I just think, like, the sheer, I mean, I say brass neck, but the balls on these guys, the sheer bloody hubris and almost like kind of, you know, it's, what do they call it? The chutzpah to just be like, yeah, we're going to influence all the governments of the world in broad daylight. You know, anybody can go and find this video on YouTube. But there he is, you know, openly talking about how to influence world leaders and basically getting those leaders to bend to their will. You know, despite quote-unquote small p politics, which is basically the national domestic concerns of politicians, you know. What he really means is this stuff may be unpopular, right? Populations may not want it. The plebs may reject it. Well, the plebs need to be fucking told. It's basically what he's saying. Again, he's never going to say this stuff like out loud, but he's getting pretty close to just openly just dictating policy to governments at this point. It is kind of just remarkable in a way. And clearly he positions himself far above like normal politics at this point. He just sees it as like a kind of petty inconvenience. Just remarkable. Anyway, let us move on now to the next one, which is when Tone sat down with, as I like to call him, Swindon branch, Jeremy Hunt, manager for hire, almost like the kind of regime. Do you remember in the Pulp Fiction when they bring in the wolf? That was what Jeremy Hunt did in this country. Oh, you know, Kwasi Kwarteng's fucked up the economy. Liz Truss is just like talking about cheese. We're going to bring in the wolf. Swindon branch manager. He's going to come in, just sort the economy out in 10 minutes. And have you noticed since Hunt has come in, the price of petrol has gone down from about 183, so like £1.83 at £1.85, almost £1.90 at one point. It's come right down now to about £1.48, £1.49 where I am. Can't help but notice that. I wonder what Jeremy did. Is he a magician or what? Strange that, isn't it? All right. Anyway, let us see Jeremy Hunt talking to the Dark Lord.
Bridge these positions. Charting a path to ensure can try and bridge these positions. Charting a path to ensuring at least some space for dialogue and cooperation with China, even as the West confronts and competes where necessary. Fourth, we have a strong foreign office, now with the old Department of Development within it.
I have to just mention once again, why is this meeting happening? Why is the Right Honourable Jeremy Hunt, Tory MP, talking to Right Honourable Tony Blair, former Prime Minister and Labour man, speaking from Chatham House? Why are these two colluding in this manner behind the back of Boris Johnson, in theory, when Hunt is out of, you know, Hunt was not in the cabinet at this point? How was it that this meeting took place and then not that long afterwards, Hunt was just kind of brought back into government out of the blue? This stuff happens in broad daylight. This is why I said you don't need the hidden hand. What the fuck is going on here? Why have we got a frontline Tory politician talking to one of the major representatives of the enemy, quote unquote, party? Anyway, let's carry on.
An agreement with the merger. I'm opposed to the cut in aid because I think we'll weaken our global claims. But we still have a big budget. The merger, if properly used, could make more coherent our foreign policy offer and make it weightier. Fifth, of course, our armed forces are globally admired. We should invest in them and make them at the cutting edge of military innovation in personnel, assets, and deployment. We should aspire also to be thought leaders. We can't alter our size, but countries do, in the old cliche, punch above their weight, and that should be our ambition. When I look at some of the countries my institute works with, they may be small population countries, but their reach is disproportionate to their size. The UK is a larger country, but the principle is the same. They have, however, all of these countries that punch above their weight, they got one thing in common, and that is political leadership.
They've got one thing in common. I fucking run them all.
Prepared to take tough, courageous, bold decisions. And here is where the state of British politics makes me queasy. Both main political parties have contradictions to resolve. The Brexit coalition, which brought the Conservative Party its election victory, consists of some who see Brexit as the facilitator of a new reforming global Britain, and others, notably in the old Labour seats of the North, who see Brexit as allowing us to return to the nation we once were. One is...
Who is that, I wonder? Is that Jeremy Hunt's wife? Has he got a... Doesn't Jeremy Hunt have a waifu who's like a Chinese spy or something? Is that her? anyway, this is quite interesting what he's saying here about the Tory coalition, right? We've got some people who want Brexit as a reforming, more global Britain, i.e. our friends who are trying to make like the gayest possible Brexit. But then we've got problem old Labour seats who want to do like horrible conservative stuff. We can't have that. We can't have that. I bet you he's about to say that.
Small R, radical. The other, small C, conservative.
Yeah, small C, conservative. That's no good. We can't have that. That's a problem, Tony is going to say.
The Labour Party also has a tension between its modernising wing, which sees radical changes coming from new forms of economic and social capital, and then its old small C conservative left, which believes that the solutions lie in the return to traditional institutions of collective and state power.
Hmm. Interesting, isn't it? The small C conservatives in both Labour and in the Tory party. Now, he's noticed this, and this is something a lot of us have noticed. I mean, David Goodhart noted this in his book. What was it? The Somewheres and the Anywheres, The Road to Somewhere, I think it was. So Tony is right on the money here with his analysis of what makes up the coalitions on both sides. But of course, it's the conservatism on both sides that is the problem. So how is Tone going to square this circle? And this is where you see Blair 101 comes in, flank from the right. We need to do something that appeals to all of these small C conservative people on both the left and the right. So ultimately they do what we want as well. That's his basic problem here. Also, he doesn't like, Tony doesn't, the radicalizing elements in the Labour Party, right, who are the wokesters and so on. He doesn't like them either. They're a pain in the ass, right? He also doesn't like the kind of more hardcore kind of libertarian wing of the, what he called the small R radicals. That's like Liz Truss, essentially, and Kwarteng and those sorts, IEA types. Tony doesn't like that either, because, of course, Tony is all about a kind of combination of quote-unquote market capitalism with very heavy regulation. You know, in other words, his third way, which was, I hate to say it, a kind of fascism, right? It's just a kind of a fascism of global elites as opposed to the sort from the mid-century. But that is essentially what it is. It's a kind of state-driven, state-controlled safety network capitalism. That's what Tony wants. So he doesn't like anything that is outside of that quote-unquote neoliberal consensus, right? So the conservatism is a problem, but the radicalism is also a problem. So let's see how he proposes to get beyond this disaster that is UK politics.
Therefore, the colossal downside risk for Britain is that the political debate continues in conventional directions. Who spends or taxes more, who supports most the NHS, who's most generous with welfare, umpteen versions of who preserves the status quo best, when it's only by rigorous analysis of the way the world is changing that we have any actual prospect of securing the future. Now, these contradictions can be resolved, and a strong, successful, outward-looking Britain can arise post-Brexit. But only if we accept Brexit of itself doesn't make it so. And without action and leadership, Brexit will only exacerbate the challenge the forces of change at work in the world present us, unless we make a supreme effort to understand these forces, harness them, and make them our servant. So this is the moment.
Make them our servant, yeah. And we need to understand these forces of change and then make them our servant. Isn't that right?
Truth for the pro-Brexit and anti-Brexit camps alike. The answers aren't going to be found in our...
Can I just say, right, I just want to point out what's happening here again, right, unless it's... There were some people watching to whom this is not obvious, right? This is the Dark Lord talking to a major Tory politician who is meant to, in theory, support Brexit, right? Jeremy Hunt is on record as supporting Brexit now, okay? He is now the Chancellor of the Exchequer, in charge of, you know, the economy of this country, in theory, okay? And Blair is openly, in broad daylight, saying, Brexit's happened, and that's a bit of a pain in the ass for our plans. We need to contain that. We need to contain it, and make it ours. We'll lemon squeeze that shit, and we'll still make this country do what we want, even though Brexit has happened. That's what he's saying. And he's not even, it's not even veiled. He is just openly saying, we need to tame what's happened. Now, bear in mind, Tony Blair wasn't just anyone during Brexit. He was like one of the leading Remain campaigners. He campaigned to have a second referendum, if you remember. He campaigned to, do you remember all that stuff, the proroguing and that bloody woman with the spider thing? Him and Alistair Campbell and Mandelson and all his old crew were doing everything in their power to stop Brexit happening in the first place, right? And now this, I mean, again, just talk about brass balls. Now, he's standing in front of one of the major Tory politicians who's on record now as having reconciled himself with Brexit and saying, right, we didn't get what we wanted, you know, when it came to stopping Brexit happening. We have to come to peace with that. But now we need to do everything humanly possible to make sure it's the Brexit that we want. And Jeremy Hunt is happy to do this in broad daylight. They are happy to install Jeremy Hunt as the Chancellor of this country in broad daylight. This is the same guy who was talking at the World Economic Forum just now about all the plans with the vax and so on. Well, you know, this also happened in broad daylight. It's not conspiracy. It's not hidden hand. It's just, you know, this is what we're doing. This is what power wants, ultimately. And there's Jeremy Hunt just kind of smiling and nodding along, you know, yes, my master, etc. So let's see what else he has to say.
Outdated ideology, but in unifying values, clarity of thinking, competence and delivery. And this is the political space, therefore, post-Brexit, that we have to inhabit. The alternative is inexorable decline. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony, for those thoughts, as ever challenging to both sides of the political spectrum. And thank you also for clarifying that mural is not a throwback to Cool Britannia, but it's actually about something much more substantive and serious. In the speech, you talk about the need for rigorous analysis of the way the world is changing. And the Center for Economics and Business Research said recently that because of the pandemic, China will now overtake the US as the world's largest economy in 2028. Now, Elon Musk, who has just become the world's richest man, once said, "The foundation of war is economics."
Porkins is saying in the audience, "Academic agent, you're an abject failure. Given your audience, do better." I tell you what, Porkins, you fucking come on this stream right now, son, okay? And we'll talk about what you've done, we'll talk about what I've done, and then we'll establish who's a failure and who is a success. How about that, Porkins? Right? Get in touch with me on Twitter. I'll have you on here right now. I am not taking any shit from anybody anymore, okay? When you've got things that you've done, when you've written 8 books, when you've got 70,000 subs, when you've had successful projects, when you've made a ton of money, then come back to me, you piece of shit. All right? Get out. Just get out. You're banned for life. Banned. All right. Let's carry on.
So should those of us who believe in democratic values, open societies, liberal democracies, should we be worried?
Yes, we should be worried, because the central challenge of liberal democracy, in my view, is not the one that we often think it is. We tend, both politicians and media, tend to think of the challenges to do with transparency or accountability. It's actually not. It's to do with efficacy. The challenge of democracy is, can you get stuff done? In a world of change, you've got to change. So if you take, for example, the healthcare debate in the UK, I mean, at the last election, you could...
No, I'm serious. I am not taking advice from fucking losers ever again. Okay? I'm sick of it. I don't listen to people who are fucking losers ever again. Okay? When you've got even a tenth of my productivity, then you can start to have a go. Until you achieve even a tenth of that, get the fuck out. All right, let's carry on.
We had the same debate on healthcare in the 1980s. I mean, you're probably too young to remember, but those are the debates back then, right? You know, Labour would say, well, the Tories would say, we love the health service, we're going to spend more. And Labour would say, well, you don't really love it, and we're going to spend even more. So the question for healthcare today in the 21st century is, how do you utilize technology, develop innovative treatment? How do you pay attention to public health and prevention and not just cure? How do you...
Prophets of Doom is finished. I handed it in yesterday.
You make sure you get the right intersection between social care and the rest of your healthcare system. Questions that require you to change systemically the way that you work. And the problem for democracy is that it's finding reform and change very difficult. And that's why it's lurched into populism, because the populist comes along and says, look, it's an easy solution, right? You build the wall or you do the Brexit or whatever. And of course, the solutions aren't easy. They're really difficult and require deep systemic change. So that is the challenge of liberal democracy today. And it's a challenge because for the first time in the world where I notice I'm going to countries, for the first time in my political lifetime, I'm going to countries. And where is the conversation I would have had with them 20 years ago? If they weren't a democracy, they'd say that's our ambition though. It's just, we can't get there at the moment, or it's going to take us time, or we're on a steady progress towards it. And now the conversation is different, frankly. The conversation's often, yeah, but you guys just don't seem to be working very well. So that's what I think. Yes, I think I happen to believe in liberal democracy passionately. You don't misunderstand me. But our challenge is effectiveness. It's how do we make change for our people in a world that needs change?
I mean, as we've seen so many times on these streams, Tony says he really passionately believes in liberal democracy, but he hates it when it's ever actually liberal, and he hates it when it's ever actually a democracy. So, I mean, it's the pesky will of the voters getting in the way again. It is the, you know, it's the fact that populations don't really want what these guys are providing. And so, you know, he works with all these governments around the world, and interestingly, they don't want to be democracies anymore. It's kind of an interesting little insight into that. It's probably because they're looking at China and thinking, well, China seems to work, whereas all these countries don't seem to work. So, you know, and I reckon in his heart of hearts, Tone also sees democracy as an inconvenience, right? And what he's talking about really with populism being the problem is exactly that. It's like, well, why aren't these people just doing as we tell them anymore?
So let me just unpick some of that. One of the things that people want with an effective government is proper managing of the economy. And indeed, one of the reasons we defeated the Soviet Union was our economic superiority and our superiority, particularly on technology. And you said in your comments just then that you thought Britain needs to be at the forefront of technological innovation. But right now there's a big debate as to whether China will in fact be the one that develops superior technology, partly because they have looser rules on privacy, which will give them an advantage with big data and AI. So how important is it, even if China becomes a larger economy overall, for the West to stay ahead on tech? And if we want to do that, how should we?
It's hugely important, and we can do it by keeping our universities really strong and developing, because they are the centers of innovation. I mean, you look at the great stuff that's coming out, even in the course of the pandemic, most of it starts with universities.
What great stuff? What great stuff is he on about? The models from Professor Lockdown. What's he talking about? Or is he talking about AstraZeneca that came out of Oxford, right? I guess. Is that what he's talking about?
You're going to need a strong environment for enterprise, for people starting businesses. You'll need to invest heavily in your education system. You need to make sure that your infrastructure is fully up to date. And we have an advantage over China, which I think will find it increasingly difficult if the more repressive position of the state starts to give people who want to start businesses and are enterprising and interested in innovation, given the sense that they can only do that within the confines of the state. But we're also going to have to change our way of thinking. I mean, it is to my mind absurd that we don't already have biometric ID.
It's only a matter of time, isn't it? It's only a matter of time before he brings up biometric ID. That's what he really was just can't get around it. Now, bear in mind that Jeremy Hunt started this by saying that, oh, China's ahead of the curve because they don't have the kind of qualms that we do about privacy and so on. Well, I mean, Tony doesn't really care about that. He wants to do the same thing as the Chinese have done. And there he is. Look at how happy he is whenever he mentions the biometric ID. There he is. He's on his hobby horse now.
Right. If you want to solve a lot of the problems that you've got around welfare fraud, anything from welfare fraud through to immigration, you need...
There you go. Welfare fraud, immigration. Right-wing talking points. And I told you, he's going to use that to sell this. That's his long-term plan, always has been.
You need...
And look, there's the grasp. It's coming out. He cannot help it. Every time he talks about this, the grasp comes out. It's incredible.
A system of identity. And all these arguments around privacy have been completely overtaken by technology. You know, so what you may remember a few years back when DeepMind was doing that experiment in the London hospitals and the clattering they got from it. But in the end, of course, you should be using technology and data. And there are all sorts of ways you can protect privacy. But if you're not, we've got a massive opportunity.
How are you going to do that? How are you going to protect privacy when you've got file on everybody? I remember that, was it a Blur song? They've got a file on you. Do you remember that? Or Kinks, you know, here come the people in grey to take you away. He's getting excited now. The blades have come out again.
With the National Health Service to be using data in a constructive way and to fuel the next.
How is the NHS and the government having all your data any different to the Chinese example that Jeremy Hunt mentioned? It's exactly the same. How is that? I mean, how is that maintaining privacy if the government have all your stuff?
Wave of innovation as a result. So that's what I mean by saying it requires political leadership that's prepared to analyze the way the world is and take the bold decisions to get there. But some of it, none of it's going to be easy.
Around the time that you became Labour leader, a writer from the US called Francis Fukuyama wrote a book called The End of History, in which he basically said liberal democracy has won, game over. Then you look at what happened on Capitol Hill last week, and also the big social divisions we've had in the wake of the financial crisis. Do you think we've just been too complacent about the superiority of Western political systems?
Interesting question. Notice, by the way, how Jeremy Hunt didn't pick Blair up on any of this privacy stuff that he set off the question with. He's just on to the next question because, as we all know, Dark Lord doesn't get hard interviews. Every interview is softball. Every interview is with a friend, right? Let's carry on.
I mean, in short, yes. The question is, what have we lost that could have circumvented some of these issues. And again, I'm just going to be very blunt with you about it, Jeremy. We lost a strong radical political center. That's the place where the best change comes from in the world today. Because the solutions are not really ideological. And the problem for the West is...
I mean, he's saying the basic problem is I stopped being prime minister. And in America, you know, the likes of the Clintons stopped being in charge. It's basically what he's saying there.
It got a bad dose of ideology just at the time when the technology revolution was meaning those solutions are completely, you know, out of date. Values matter. It's not that you know, values and ideals don't matter.
But fuck ideology. Exactly right, Tone. BS, 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 therefore I rule. Right? Fuck ideology, it's in the way. So I basically agree with Blair on this, but my solutions would be different from his, of course.
But the practical job of making your societies fit for purpose and making sure, for example, that people's wages can carry on rising because you're lifting productivity, you know, those in the end are resolved, I'm afraid, by people who understand the way the world is and acting with the right values and making the right changes. And that's what we've lost.
I'm afraid to say, basically, those people who understand how the world works, basically me and my friends, need to be making the decisions. Okay? So everybody else can stop with their nonsense ideology and just let us technocrats take over again. That's his frustration. Politics keeps on getting in the way of the things he wants. Although, as we've seen, they still get their own way quite a lot anyway.
And I mean, this is just my view. You know, a lot of people disagree with it. But I think the fact that the centre then became the place to protect the status quo in an era where people want change, it kind of corroded the centre and he went off. You know, you can see in our own politics. Your party went off after Brexit. My party went off after Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, hey, presto, here we are.
Isn't the critique of the centre that politicians who espoused centrist policies just made one really huge screw up, which is that they lost touch with a very important chunk of their electorate, whether in Britain, the US or continental Europe, which is essentially those parts of the electorate that don't have university degrees. It's about half of US voters, about two thirds in Europe.
Now, this is a very good question from Jeremy Hunt, because he's actually starting to get to why populism is a thing, because people, you know, aren't benefiting from this and haven't benefited from it for many years now. Very good question, Dark Lord displeased, but let's see what he's going to say.
And if you look at Attlee's cabinet, for example, half of the members of that cabinet had blue collar backgrounds. But by the time you came to power, it was, I think, just one of your cabinet ministers had a blue collar background. So do we not need to put that right?
Yeah, a few more than one, but I don't really think this is correct analysis, actually. First of all, by the way, inevitably, as you know, you're only
Blair so displeased that something off narrative was introduced into the mix. You can see, like, he's like, I'm not happy. Just incorrect analysis, Jeremy. Demerit, Jeremy Hunt.
Evans today would be going to university. I mean, it's just the way it is, right? As education improved and more people went to university, this was inevitable. And so, you know, people like John Prescott, Alan Milburn were bound to be exceptional by the time you start to get to that that period of time. But the other thing is that, you see, the centre, to hold it, you always had to hold, for example, for the Labour Party, we always had to hold together a coalition of very traditional working class, aspirant working class, and the socially liberal. If you look at the what New Labour had, it was those elements together. And, you know...
Very true. This is spot on. And they've lost this right side, right? If you go back to Jonathan Bowden's speeches and things in like 2008, 2010, this side that he's talking about, the socially conservative, traditional working class, was exactly BNP recruiting grounds back then. You know, Bowden giving speeches to them. They were the people who ended up voting for Brexit. They are the people who ultimately who watched Sargon. That is Sargon, basically, right? Is this voter over here? In another lifetime, he would have just been a bog standard Labour voter, right? Now, I mean, if you're here, Carl, tell me if I'm wrong, right? I'm not talking about you now. I'm talking about you like 5, 10 years ago, something like that. You know, frankly, that would have been like, you know, my buddy Morgoth. He would have just been there once upon a time, like, you know, back in the 60s or something. You know, my mother's family were all in this part, right? That is the section that Labour have lost. And he's well aware of this. So let's see where he goes with this.
So I'm always happy to take responsibility for the things that I actually did in government. But we did not ignore that working class element when we were in government, which is why even in 2005, we retained the vast majority of those seats that are now.
Yeah, I'm not saying Morgoth's that old. I'm saying that if the equivalent of Morgoth and his exact social background and so on, he would have just been of that stripe back in the 60s or something like that. Obviously, things have changed now. You know, that's ultimately how all of those people ended up on the quote unquote, you know, far right or whatever, you know.
Now fall into the Conservatives. No, it was, in fact, the Labour Party moving away from both that aspirant working class and traditional working class and becoming locked into a sort of far left plus socially liberal that lost us a huge chunk of our constituency.
100% spot on. 100% spot on. This is entirely right. You'll find many, many videos from friends of ours who've made this exact point over and over again. This is like Carl Benjamin 2015, you know, over and over again. Right. I didn't leave the left left me. Right. This is 100% true, because these people over here, you know, they wanted state power to be used to intervene in the economy, aka socialism. Right. But they were conservative. They weren't woke. They were socially conservative. Blair, more than anyone else in the Labour Party, understood that fundamentally. That's why he always did the flank from the right, because he was doing the flank from the right to stop nationalist parties like the BNP or the Tories stealing those votes from the traditional working class. Because he knew that he couldn't take them for granted if the party was seen as being too, Islington or too like woke. That is why the Blair triangulation was so electorally successful, because he always presented himself in this right on that right hand side of the screen, in a way that spoke the language that some of those voters would understand. Now, obviously, some people saw through it, right? Because he was never quite being sincere. It was always a ruse, or it was always a kind of strategy that he was playing. Right, it's a containment strategy ultimately, but he did it well enough to win three elections on the bounce. And what Blair is trying to do is get the party back to that. And what I have said so often is that that is Labour at their most dangerous, and that's where Starmer is taking them now, because that's when they can really start to change things, when people believe that actually they are, you know, I mean, another time I might do a stream. Looking at, there's an amazing thread on Twitter of people noting all of the kind of quote unquote base things that the New Labour did. And they, to be fair to them, they did do an awful lot of things that, I think Sargon said on Twitter, compared to the Tory party now, Blair's Labour look almost like far right, some of the stuff they did. On crime, on immigration, because how can I put this? Blair's government, and especially when David Blunkett was the Home Secretary, They didn't care about civil liberties at all. They trample all over civil liberties if it meant showing on paper that they were putting their money where their mouth was, right? And okay, I mess around a bit with the whole based Blair thing, right? But they did do an awful lot of things that if you just changed the name and just wrote them down on paper, you'd be like, well, I'd support that. And that's what made them so deadly, because it looked like they were doing all sorts of stuff. Whereas, of course, on the other side of things, they were taking a hatchet job to our unwritten constitution and our institutions, and he was replacing all of the infrastructure of the country with Blair cronies, essentially. You know, that's what the Supreme Court is, that's what Ofcom is, that's what all of those extra governmental bodies that were set up under Blair is basically like Blair friends, okay? Globalists, people who basically are on the same page as him. This is how he managed to almost to kind of like remain in government, even though he left government. That's how he did it. But politically speaking, this appeal to the socially conservative side was the genius of Blair. That's how he was able to do it. Anyway, let's carry on.
So I think it's, and you know, in the end, the way that you, the centre that I'm describing, the way it keeps those people with us is to be carrying on making change. It's only when it becomes the place of the status quo and just says, look, all these people, we're reasonable, and all those other guys chasing Donald Trump and Brexit, they're unreasonable. You're never going to win the debate on that basis. You've got to be in touch with those people, but showing how you can improve their lives in a practical way. And that's, I'm afraid, what we lost. And that's why for an issue like immigration, you know, all the time I would always say to people, I'm in favor of immigration for the UK. I think it's done an immense amount for the UK, but you can't treat it as an issue that people don't care about or be indifferent to their anxieties. So I would always say, you've got to have a system with rules, otherwise you'll get one with prejudices. So, you know, these are the things that keep you together. It's why law and order for me was a Labour issue. Because in working class...
See, look, he's starting to speak our language now. You see, even there'll be some of you watching this who are starting to get drawn. Don't look at his eyes, don't look at his hands. Cover up where he is. But this is the sort of shit. You know, he's starting to make those sorts of noises that make people on our side of things excited, right? And to be fair to them, they did do an awful lot of stuff on law and order, on immigration, on all sorts of things. They created something called a hostile environment that people still talk about today under Blunkett. Gordon Brown created a British citizenship test that I think people still have to take, even to this day. Probably the Tories got rid of that because it was too conservative or whatever, right? But I mean, in fact, I was going through some of those and saying, like, the Tories actually got rid of some of the stuff that New Labour did. So it is a bizarre thing. But when it comes to the containment side of Blair, this is what I'm saying. It's like you almost want a competent, like, he's evil, right? But he's competent. And that means that he knows that people are only going to believe him when he says this stuff if they actually do something, right? This is how you end up with, like, Tony Blair locking up more black people than any prime minister in history and things like that. Yes, base Blair is a meme. I'm messing around a little bit. But also, in a way, he's preferable to fucking Theresa May and Boris Johnson and bloody Rishi Sunak, who actually don't even do that. They don't even do that. They have trebled immigration since they've been in power. They've done away with the hostile environment. They've done away with all of the bloody stop and search. That was a Blair policy. It's actually remarkable that the Tories have made the country gayer than it was under New Labour. Right. I'm not saying that Blair isn't an evil fuck. What I'm saying is that the Tories are even worse. So in a strange way, I mean, it's going to be grim when Starmer comes in, right? It's going to be grim because the media are going to stop scrutinizing the government, right? And it's going to be grim because they're going to do, you know, Labour are going to make even more like horrible changes to the country. Okay. But in a strange way, they may do some of this stuff better. And in the short term, just make the place that like even slightly more tolerable to live in. You know, because Labour don't give two shits about pissing off Owen Jones. Whereas the Tories like bend over backwards to appease him. So it's a bizarre dynamic, but anyway, let's carry on.
Last communities, they're the people that suffer from law and order, not the people who can afford to live in a nice part of town.
Before we move on to the audience, I just want to ask you a couple of things about the international picture, because many people think that the Western alliance has totally broken down. And you made a fascinating comment about how real alliances are actually forged in adversity. So what needs to happen to put together the group of countries, not all in the West, actually, by any means, but who believe in open societies? What's Britain's role in making that happen? Robin Niblett of Chatham House argued this week that global Britain is something that needs to be earned and not declared. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And I think he put his finger on a very, very important point, I guess.
I mean, they're talking in 2021 here, but something, some adversity, a crisis that could bring the open societies together, that could bring the West together. What could it be? A war, maybe. A war. That might be a thing to bring the NATO countries back together, eh, Tone? Just a little thought.
This is the point I'm making too. But with the G7, we've got a chance to do something here. I mean, you've got two major issues in which the West should show leadership, which is COVID and climate. Those are both issues where Britain, as the leader of the G7, can play a real part. I mean, the absence of global cooperation over the pandemic, as you know, you and I have both said, Jeremy, has been shocking. It's been a real abdication of leadership. And what is very clear to me now about the pandemic is that we're just in a new phase of it. So you're going to find in the next year, I think, that we're going to have to be adapting vaccines to new strains of the disease. And the thing that's really changed, in my view, about the disease in the last few weeks, which is why there's this enormous global pressure to acquire vaccines, is that most policymakers thought you would have three phases to this pandemic. You'd have a starting phase where you lock down. You'd then have a second phase where you had control of the disease, but were living with it for a time. And then you'd have a third phase, reasonably steady, where you rolled out the vaccine. What's happened is that second phase has collapsed. You're now lockdown or mass vaccination. And so for Britain, for example, leading the G7 at the moment, it could be mobilizing how we make sure we cure some of the problems that have been exposed in the manufacturing.
I mean, it's clear something went wrong with their COVID plans to me, right? And I just find that, I mean, again, I'm not saying that like Putin was in on this or whatever. It's just funny that a war, that just as like their COVID plans were kind of collapsing, this war provided exactly the pretext that they needed to, you know, solve this problem that you're talking about here. How do we get mass cooperation between the Western nations? Well, COVID didn't do it, right? He's basically moaning about the fact that not every country adopted the same strategy. You know, you had rogue people in America like DeSantis. You had Sweden didn't lock down properly. He's basically complaining that they didn't follow this plan. And so I just find it really interesting that at exactly the moment that the regime needed it, they almost got like a Hail Mary from Putler. Amazing, really. Anyway, let's see what else he says.
Production, in the research and development, data surveillance, we could be plugging some of those gaps now so that if in the autumn time we're having to develop new vaccine, or in the summer, new vaccines in order to deal with new strains of the disease, we're doing it far faster. And we do it, again, Britain could play a real part in saying we can't have a situation where the wealthy countries get the vaccines first and the poor countries have got to wait several months later. So, no, there's no doubt, but the earning point is really important. I mean, I can't tell you how often I learned this lesson when I was prime minister. If you don't commit, and committing is always painful, you don't get anything back in return. And what often happens with politicians and political leaders is they feel their own politics so keenly, they don't see the other person's politics. And I can just tell you, you forge those relationships and those alliances where the leader you're sitting opposite sees you taking some pain in order to make that alliance work. Then they're with you.
Genius. Just politics one, like Machiavelli 101. It's just brilliant. Also interesting, right? Because coming back to the war, how many leaders have we seen commit in the way that Tony's saying? How many leaders have you seen commit and take some quote-unquote pain for it as well? Very interesting to me. Very interesting indeed.
Thank you. Now, I've just got a couple more questions for you, Tony. And just to tell everyone else, if you want to ask a question to Tony, please type it into the chat function, and then I will relay those questions to Tony. But you did generously say you were happy to talk about your own record. And I wonder whether I could just ask you about a...
Surely they're not taking questions from the audience. Tone would never agree to that. Not like random members of the public, surely. That chat must be extremely vetted, I'd have thought. It's not going to be like a random, like, it won't be plebs. It'll be a hand-picked audience because Tony doesn't deal with the public anymore.
A couple of aspects of that which have some salience in modern politics. And one of them, you know, you talked about committing, and your probably biggest international commitment was to Iraq. And I just wonder whether you think some of the challenges we face in the Western alliance relate to a loss of moral authority from military endeavours like Iraq, but not just Iraq, Libya could be another one, which haven't turned out as expected.
I don't think it's a loss of moral authority, but what people question is whether, because I think most people who are sensible don't question the motives behind it. I think what people question is, did it work out in the way...
Most people who are sensible don't question the motives for it. Sensible centre.
That what was planned, and the answer to that is no. So the issue really is, what lesson do you learn from that? And I suppose, again, what I would say is you've got to be careful that you don't learn the wrong lesson. You've got to learn the right lessons and not the wrong ones. The right lesson is that and this was the lesson we learned again with the Arab Spring, frankly, is that when you remove the dictatorship, which has been suppressing a whole set of forces within a country for a long period of time, then once you remove that dictatorship, those forces come to the surface and you're in a whole new stage of conflict. But learning the lesson you therefore, which is the lesson a lot of politicians have learned, that you therefore...
How didn't they know that beforehand? Who'd have guessed removing Saddam Hussein would cause like fucking chaos in Iraq? Come on. They must have known.
Stay out of all of these situations. Well, you know, that is what means that the future of Syria today is going to be determined by Russia and Iran, who have, by the way, committed over 10 years. And Libya, probably, I don't know. Turkey, Russia are probably the two main players at the moment there. Even though we were instrumental in removing the regime. So I think the important thing is to is yes, of course, to ensure that whatever you're doing is done accordance with the right principles and for the right purposes. But I still think the basic point about commitment is clear. And, you know, you're not going to be able to determine the future, for example, of what is happening. You take what I think is the next big arena, which is the Sahel in the northern part of sub-Saharan Africa, where you could get new waves of extremism and migration. I mean, are the Western nations really committed to trying to help that situation? Much of which, by the way, has come from the destabilization in Libya. I'm not sure that we really are. But if we don't, in some years' time, we'll be faced with the consequences of that.
Finally, from me, and before we move on to the audience.
Why did they do it in the first? Why did they fucking remove Gaddafi in the first place? I'm not buying this from surely the neocons knew back then that removing these dictators would create chaos. They are not that naive. I do not. This is utter bullshit from Blair. Utter bullshit. This is one of his least convincing answers ever on one of these Dark Lord watches. Utter bullshit from Blair.
You talked in your comments about the importance of holding the country together in this post-Brexit period. Have things gone according to plan in terms of the devolution settlement that you gave to Scotland?
Well, when I was in office, I would say that...
Come on, admit it, Tone. It was one of your biggest fuck-ups. Now you've got bloody... Nicola Sturgeon up there, permanently a blight on the country. You caused that.
After the initial creation of the Scottish Parliament and devolution, it wasn't really a major factor for me as a Prime Minister. I think what happened subsequent and what has put Scottish independence back centre stage again are two things. First of all, the Labour Party lost its position in Scotland completely, but I think for reasons that were avoidable.
Basically, because I was gone. That was the problem. I wasn't controlling the party anymore for that period. Notice how he won't own anything. So it was just somebody else's fuck up.
And really, the only effective opposition that's come to the SNP in the last decade was actually when Ruth Davidson was the Conservative Party leader in Scotland. But that's a whole other discussion. And the second thing was Brexit put it back on the agenda again. I mean, I'm not just making a sort of crass anti-Brexit point, but I mean, the fact is it's given the nationalists a whole new lease of life, because don't forget there was actually a referendum in 2014 and Scotland voted to stay in the UK.
Thank you. Well, we've got a lot of questions and we've got to finish at 2 o'clock, but I'm going to try and get through as many as I can, and I may group some of them to try and make sure that we can get through all of them. But let me just start with this question from Leslie.
I love how he's doing the wide stance for the questions. Ready for this? Surely these have been vetted, these questions. I can't believe random members of the public would be allowed to ask him questions.
Birch, who says, it seems to me the US and UK constitutions are out of date and we are no longer representative democracies. Do you agree, and what reforms would you advocate on the constitutional side?
Are we not representative democracies?
This is not my question, I have to say, but you know,
I think we are
constitutional reform.
I mean, to be absolutely blunt about it, I was always a skeptic that you could solve a political problem, what is essentially a politics problem, with constitutional change, which is not to say I don't, you know, I exclude those things. We did a lot of constitutional change to the government, but no, I...
Based on Schmidt-pilled.
I think the basic point is that politics has become deeply polarised. And in the end, democracy is not just about a form, it's about a substance and a spirit. And you can have a form of democracy as people casting their vote. But if one half of the country hates the other half of the country, you're going to find, as the Americans have just found, that legitimacy starts to get challenged, even when it really shouldn't and can't be on any sensible basis. And that's the biggest worry. That's why I say my view is the spirit of a democracy is people being prepared to disagree with each other and still be amicable with each other. And when you get, and social media, of course, itself is a revolutionary phenomenon in the political arena. When you get these violent separations of opinion, that is when democracy can be put at risk. And I think that is, I would focus more on that political challenge, because I don't think in the end, any amount of constitutional change could solve that. Apart from, by the way, in the American context, ensuring that they stop.
I mean, he is skirting around some really basic elite theory points here, because really there is no scope for disagreement. There really is no scope for disagreement. It's basically what he's saying. You can't really have a situation where people become friend and enemy within a state, right? The enemy has to be outside the state. And the problem is there's been this separation where the friend and enemy, the Schmittian friend and enemy, is internal in American politics and also in British politics. Although I think they've put that to bed a little bit recently. That's basically what he's getting at. There's a Schmitt essay I've got here somewhere. I can't remember what it's called now. It's the little book he's got on parliamentary democracy, where he makes exactly these points that Blair's making here. It can't really work, liberal democracy, if there's a genuine disagreement between the two sides. The two sides basically have to be on the same page on like 99% of issues. Hence, how we joke about the uniparty, right? And we all know ultimately that's what Blair wants. He wants a situation where the two sides are Jeremy Hunt and Tony Blair, who basically agree on like 99% of things. They may disagree, you know, is it a 1p tax rise or a 50p tax rise? They may disagree on that, but fundamentally, their spirit is in the same place. They have the same values. They agree on what the problems are. They agree on all those sorts of things. And that's ultimately what Blair is saying here. There isn't really scope for substantive disagreement between the two parties. And that is one of many reasons, of course, why democracy is ultimately a sham. It is literally just the kind of will of the ruling class behind a smokescreen. And the problem we've got now, of course, is that the political class is just nowhere near where most of the public are. But of course, Blair's never going to say that, because he always backs himself to change the mind of the public.
Changing their constituencies so that they're now just red or blue. That is going to be a huge problem for America in years to come. But I think there's a political challenge here, not a constitutional one, is my honest opinion.
Thank you. Now, we've got a couple on international relations. Merwin Balatresh from the Kuwait News Agency asks, what's the best way to engage with China? And Dominic Karatu says, David Miliband recently talked about the age of impunity, given that we're not likely to confront...
Yeah, and clearly these aren't members of the public, by the way. They're journalists and, you know, think tank people and, you know... They're fellow elites, essentially. They're not plebs asking the questions.
Militarily, Russia, China, or Iran, do you support an interventionist foreign policy?
So on the first, in my view, what we need with China is what I call a strategic framework for engagement with China, and not a series of ad hoc reactions to individual actions of China. So... thing we have to understand about China is China is now a risen power, and it's right that it is one of the big powers in the world. It's right by dint of history, civilization, size of population, size of economy, and now technology, innovation. The problem is that over the past few years, China has come under a much stricter and stronger control of the Communist Party again. It's reasserted a very iron grip on the country, and that's meant more repression internally and more aggression externally. In my view, the basic principles should be that we need this strategic framework, which should accept we confront China where it's doing things that are unacceptable or contrary to our basic values. We will have to compete with them because competition is going to be natural, but we still need to cooperate with them in certain key areas. Climate is one, the pandemic is another, actually stabilizing the global economy, yet another. So there's no way out of, in my view, that engagement with China. The question is, what's the best format to do it in? And in my view, there is where America and Europe should try and form a common position, and Britain can play a part in trying to reach that common position. Because the most dangerous thing would be if you have these two rival powers.
Note, by the way, how his solution to all things is to consolidate bigger blocks of power, bigger blocks of, you know, unified decision-making units, effectively. And when he's saying, oh, yeah, Britain can have a role in this, he's basically talking about himself or his friends. You know, basically, everybody has to be on the same page. And that page is the one that I give them, essentially, or my friends give them. That's Blair's answer to everything. You know, you saw it in the earlier one where he wants like a common African position, a common European position. He basically just wants the whole world working in unison, even when it comes to his China strategy here.
Powers, America and China, and Europe starts to navigate between them. I think that would be a mistake, because in the end, the Chinese system will have to evolve. I don't think you can keep that tight grip on a people that's going to become increasingly prosperous over time. So we need to do that very carefully. I am in favor of intervening where it's, you know, necessary or sensible, and where it can be done, you know, to protect our interests. But that doesn't always mean, you know, hard military power. You know, people forget we also, apart from military interventions, we created the Department of International Development, we trebled the aid budget. And, you know, our cooperation with the United States on aid brought about the PEPFAR program in the US, which is probably the biggest life-saving program the continent of Africa has ever seen. So, you know, there are lots of different ways you can. I've always seen this isolationism versus interventionism. For me, it's never been about, do you put your country's interests first or someone else's interests first? I've always seen it as part of enlightened self-interest to be prepared to intervene in the world. But as I say, that doesn't necessarily mean militarily.
Thank you. Now,
enlightened self-interest, yeah.
Question from Federico Bianchi, who's head of press for the EU delegation to the UK. But it's not about Brexit. It's about the role of social media and disinformation, and how in a democracy do we balance the need to uphold our values of free speech with avoiding being weakened or threatened in a way that we saw on Capitol Hill last week?
Yeah, it's a great question. I honestly wish I knew the answer to it, and I don't. I mean, social media makes political life very, very difficult today, and it can't really be the case that the CEOs of these companies take the decision as who gets a platform and who doesn't. So I think there's going to be, and it's an area, by the way, there's no reason why the UK and Europe shouldn't work together on this.
There he is again. Everything's an opportunity to bring countries together, to make people work together under a common purpose. Remember that phrase, common purpose, friends? Have a little look into that phrase.
To look at what is the right regulatory framework for social media. And if there's one, you know, I spoke a bit about Britain being a thought leader. You know, one of the good things about Britain is, you know, we tend to be, you know, most of the time quite reasonable people. And, you know, we share an immense amount in common with European countries, even if we're now out of the EU. And I think getting the right framework for this is going to be important because, again, to go back to the point about democracy, if you can't exchange information in a reasonable way with some, at least some approximation between facts that are accurate and facts that aren't, it becomes hard to have a democratic political debate. And I think this whole, you know, I've been saying for a long time, this issue to do with social media technology companies, you've got to take this out of the realm of that, of the corporate, and it's got to become a public interest debate with some public interest regulation around it.
Take it out of the hands of the corporations. Give it to one of my extra governmental regulators. Ofcom, for example. Right, Tone? Or I don't know if in America, I didn't even know if that exists, but you know, he's not against the idea of picking and choosing who stays on a platform and who doesn't. He just wants governmental oversight on it so that he can ensure that it is exactly his man making that decision. So you don't get the disaster of Elon Musk controlling Twitter, for example. There has to be some, that, and that's his answer to so many things. A regulator can come in. A regulator can take that decision. And they'll say, oh, it's an independent regulator, right? Like Ofcom, for example. But of course, everybody knows that Ofcom is not independent. It's part of the regime. So that's his answer to so many things, that he's not happy with it. I mean, even though corporations are under managerial control, as we've talked about so many times, there's always that risk of the Elon Musk situation happening, right? And he doesn't want that. He wants the safety of the decision being made by his guys 100% of the time. Note he has absolutely no qualms whatsoever about the actual deplatforming element. What he cares about is who's making the decision.
Now, quite what that is the thing I think is really difficult, but the present situation can't be maintained. And I think the public themselves are anxious now about the damage that social media debate does to our political system.
Thank you. Now, this is Diego Salama from the United Nations University, and he says, what role should the UK play in the UN and the multilateral system in general, and how do we justify our seat and our permanent veto on the Security Council?
Well, you know, it's there's a very strong case for the reform of the UN Security Council. But having tried to initiate a debate about this when I was Prime Minister and signally failing to get anywhere with it.
I missed that bit about the UN University. What's the UN University? You mentioned that just now, but I missed that bit.
You know, I'm not sure there's a very easy solution because Britain's not going to give up its place on the Security Council. But on the other hand, of course, you look at the world today and say, well, India shouldn't be permanent member of it, Germany, Japan, and then you can start running through a whole series of countries. I think the UN system needs deep reform. I think it would be great if Britain played a part in leading that debate. But, you know, my experience with these things is they only come about when they're forced by necessity. And I want Britain to play there's no reason outside of Brexit why Britain shouldn't be a strong multilateral partner, both in the UN and elsewhere. And, you know, we still got, even with the proposed cuts, a very large, significant aid budget, a great footprint on the ground in many parts of the world. So I'm happy for us to play a part in the UN and other multilateral bodies, but
keep an eye on those foreign aid budgets, by the way, because that is also part of the grift network. Those foreign aid budgets go and fund directly all of the Blair Institute's partners. If you do a deep dive on that whole network, UK government money goes and funds all of that. It's an entire grift network, basically the NGO complex that is kept afloat by that mandatory foreign aid budget that they stick in there. So
I do think our multilateral system needs deep reform, and I would include the UN in that.
And from Tom Harris, you talked about a number of challenges that we've got to face, including China and political relations with other countries. Does having a more liberal US president make that easier?
Well, American policy is going to be more predictable, and it's going to be more multilateral. So in that sense, yes, I think is the answer to that. I think the only thing I think is important is that the new administration, which has got, a lot of very talented people who were part of the Obama administration. But, you know, the world of 2021 is not the same as the world of 2017. And I think it will be easier with this administration, but we need a lot of creativity and new thinking, as well as just being prepared to sit down at the table with all our allies and get along. And you can see this, you know, there will be some very tricky issues between America and Europe, even if there's a great desire all to work together. Even this Biden administration is going to be saying, yeah, but come on China, are you guys with us or you're not with us? You know, and on NATO, they're going to be saying, yes, of course, we're not going to treat you like.
Notice how Ukraine fixed all these problems, by the way. All these issues that they were talking about in 2021 basically were solved by Ukraine, you know, in terms of how you bring Europe under the heel of America properly again. Well, I mean, all of that's happened now.
Donald Trump, but by the way, we agree you should be increasing your defense spending. So I think, yes, it will be easier because it will be a lot more predictable, but I don't think we shouldn't settle back into our comfort zone. You know, that would be a mistake.
Thank you. Now, a couple of questions. Wasik says, what does the center need to do, as in, I think, centrist thinkers need to do in Britain to evolve against the polarization of toxic identity politics being imported from the US? And Kamina Banga asks,
was that one of our guys slipping in a question there? Was that who slipped in that question about quote unquote toxic identity politics?
Can democracies really bring about systemic change when the parliamentary term is just 4 to 5 years?
So the way of, you know, my view, especially for progressive politics, identity politics is a complete dead end. If you end up fighting on that basis, you're just going to end up probably with large periods of conservative government.
Notice how Blair always wants to put the woke away. He is dead against, he's always been against the woke, right? Because he knows it's a loser for the left, right? And, Jeremy there, you know, with some tiny bit of pretense that these two guys are on opposite sides of the fence. I mean... You know, his eyes lit up as if to say, like, oh, great, we, quote unquote, get to stay in power. I mean, if this interview doesn't make it obvious that there's no fucking difference between the two parties, I don't know what does, right? Corbyn was different, right? Corbyn was an outsider, and that's obvious watching this. This is the Uni Party right here. It's Jeremy Hunt and Tony Blair. They want your political choice between this guy here and whoever the Blair proxy is on Labour, which is Keir Starmer, as we know.
For me, the challenge for progressive politics, to put it in very simple terms, and I think the same is true, the challenge to the centre, is focus on what is the big real world change And the big real world change is technology. So technology is going to change and should change everything. It's going to change the way we work. Well, it already is changing the way we work. It changes the way we interact with each other. It's going to change every single area of policy you can think of. If you have a discussion today, even with in areas where you don't think of technology being the dominant thing, but you sit down with some...
Can I always tell when Blair's a bit turned on because the grass comes out, you know, and technology turns him on as well. The other part, you know, technology basically is making him think of the digital ID. So you get the power grip comes out once more.
People in the defense sector today, 50% of the conversations about technological change. You know, we're going to have, here and around the world, we're going to have electric vehicles that are driverless, right? We're going to...
Hellscape. Absolute hellscape. Electric vehicles that are driverless. Ugh. Oh, I mean, his vision is so dystopian. I don't want to live in his future. And we are going to live in his future. We're already heading there. It's horrible.
They defined as artificial intelligence progresses that whole sectors of the economy get changed massively. So my view is it's rather like the 19th century Industrial Revolution. If you look back in history, Whigs and...
This is pure Klaus Schwabian bullshit he's coming out with here. He's talking about the fourth industrial revolution, right? Whatever they talk about. This is like pure WEF stuff right here.
Tories carried on arguing about old things years into the Industrial Revolution. It took politics a long time to catch up with the real world change. And the best way to overcome a lot of the divisions is to take this revolution and say, well, look, how do we make it work for people? How do we make sure that we can improve their lives through this? Which, of course, by the way, most of this technology is going to be enormously enabling.
Yeah, it's going to enable us to have 15-minute bloody transport zones. It's going to enable people like Tony Blair to dictate where you can drive to. It's, you know, all right, let's carry on.
And that's the thing. So you rise above the identity politics by having a unifying economic and social message, which is making this revolution work for people. And I honestly believe that...
Look at Hunt, right? Hunt is just so fucking dead behind the eyes. He's just nodding along, you know. He basically agrees with everything he's saying here. He is 100... Don't forget, Jeremy Hunt's meant to be a Tory politician. Jeremy Hunt is meant to be against Tony Blair. Jeremy Hunt is meant to be the Chancellor of this country representing the Conservative Party. Fucking nothing. Just nodding along, yeah, right on tone, you know.
First group of politicians that understand this technology revolution, master and harness it, will be the ones that win. And the second question was around the...
4 to 5, the short parliamentary term.
Yeah, it's... Well, I think it's less to do with the parliamentary term. It's to do really with having a clear vision and policy and being prepared to drive it through in circumstances where the thing I learned about government is when I was making reforms, the rhythm was almost always like this. You proposed a reform, people told you it was a bad idea. Whilst you were doing the reform, it was hell. And after you'd done the reform, you wish you'd done more of it. And, you know, people forget this now, but if you go back in when Margaret Thatcher was making her reforms, and leave aside whether you agree or disagree, I mean, there were times when she fell into third place, you know, in the politics. And, you know, in the end, the problem today, I think you're not going to get out of 4 or 5 year terms, but the problem is you've got to articulate.
The problem is that I'm not in power forever. That's what he really wants to say. That is what he's weaseling around here. He's like, the problem is that we don't have a permanent government and then we have to deal with these fucking elections and the bloody pretense of people having views and politics. We just need to drive home what I want all the time. Permanent technocratic government. That's what he really wants to say, but he can't, obviously he can't say it, right?
A vision, and then really get behind it and spend your political capital on trying to push it through. And I learned this too late, in fact, in some ways, in my time as Prime Minister, because in the end, there isn't any change you're ever going to make that isn't painful. And therefore, the risk is, and this is the challenge of democracy in a sense, the risk is you're so busy trying to remain popular that you just sort of keep the status quo and dabble with it here and there. When, as I say, in an era where the world's massively changing, if you're not adapting to that change, you just get left behind. And I think that is the big challenge, but it can only be, it's a challenge that's easier.
Look at Hunt. What is he thinking behind those eyes? Oh, if Jeremy Hunt doesn't scare you, I don't know what planet you're on. Don't forget, he's the Chancellor now, and he's just gazing into the Dark Lord's eyes here, lapping this shit up, right? But of course, he's thinking, yes, we need to do unpopular things. And look at the Tory party now, right? The Tory party at the moment have certain approval ratings which show them only getting 10 seats. Now, that was a left-wing poll, admittedly, right? But even the most optimistic polls have them losing by a landslide at the moment, right? But look at all the stuff Jeremy Hunt is doing. Jeremy Hunt is doing, from his own point of view and from the point of view of people like Blair, stuff that needs to be done. Fuck being popular, right? And this is how Blair is thinking. He's like, well, Thatcher needed to do shit that needed to be done. There were some times where she was really unpopular too. But you can always change that when the election campaign comes around. And you watch now, right? The election is about 2 years away, right? I'll put money on it. That election will be closer than we think it is. Everybody's predicting a landslide for Labour now. But you wait until they're back in campaign mode. And the bullshit will start again. And the Tories will win people back. They always do. I still think Labour will win. But I don't think it will be the kind of blowout that people are predicting at the moment. Based on what Blair said here, right? There were times where it would look like Thatcher was going to get blown out. And she won 3 elections on the bounce. And even after that, John Major defeated Neil Kinnock. Even after Thatcher. So, just saying that. This is someone who really understands politics. Right, we can hate him, but he is really correct on a lot of the things he's saying when it comes to the nuts and bolts. Right, he's an evil bastard, and I hate his vision of the world and everything else, but he's fundamentally correct, and this is why Jeremy Hunt is gazing with such like open admiration at him right here.
To meet, if you're, you know, in the end, you've got to trust the people. You've got to have a bold, clear vision and say, OK, it's going to mean changes. They're going to be difficult. It's going to be very hard going, but we're going to see it through. And my view is that politics still wins.
People are doubting my prediction that it won't be a blowout, right? But, like, honestly, the Tories are masters at this game, right? Don't expect them, don't put it past them to do all sorts of shenanigans like bringing Boris back, or they'll do it. If that's what it takes, they'll do it as well. Just not to make it a blowout. Even if bringing Boris back just to kind of lose, and then they can kill two birds with one stone. Populism is well and truly dead, they can say, which will give people like Hunter a way of kind of selling centrism back to the party again. It will stop them being completely destroyed, like what we want to happen and what Peter Hitchens wants to happen and so on. So a lot can happen in 2 years. A lot can happen in 2 years. So, you know, I'm still... Don't forget, they don't have to call an election until they want to. I think, was it the absolute limit? It's like 5 years, right? Well, Boris won in 2019, didn't he, right? 2019, 2020. Right, I mean, they've got until the end of next year, essentially, because Boris won in Christmas time, I seem to recall. So they've got until December next year to call an election. And if they leave it to the very last minute, a lot can change in 2 years. And Starmer is not a great candidate as well, don't forget. So, you know, I still think Labour will win, but it might not be as bad for the Tories as it looks right now.
It's in the end. But the problem is a lot of politicians, particularly with social media battering them today, you know, they think that's just a suicidal kamikaze type mission.
So we're coming to a close, but I've just got three final questions, if I may. The first is from Julia McFarlane of ABC News, and it relates directly to what you said about getting ahead of the curve on the technology debate. And she's talking about the decision by Twitter to ban Trump. And she asks, should we have specialised ethics committees to decide whether or not governments should have ultimate control or regulate private companies such as Twitter and Facebook?
Yeah, so my institute put out a paper on this a few months back. I mean, I think you've got to treat these companies to a degree as public interest companies. And no, it can't be right that the CEO of the company decides whether the President of the United States has a platform or not. So you're going to have to find some way of getting a system of regulation that is not simply driven by the views of the company. So I think this will be, this is a big, you know, it's a part of what is a big debate, which is how do you regulate these large technology companies that have an influence politically of an outsized amount. And I don't think you can do that unless you accept to a degree they are public interest companies and not just private corporates.
Thank you. And a question from...
Can they do it? Well, Elon Musk is the question now. Can they do it with Musk now that it's 100% private company again? Interesting question.
James Strong, who says, there's a lot of negativity in the world at the moment. What are you optimistic about in 2021?
You know, what I'm optimistic about is that at one level, if you see what this pandemic has posed us as a challenge, you know, the world has carried on functioning. I mean, it's been tough and difficult, but I'm optimistic about the opportunities of technological change. I'm optimistic because even, you know, I spend a lot of time out in the Middle East. I see things happening there that make me optimistic. The Israel, United Arab Emirates Accords, for example, which I worked on quite a lot. And then I spend a lot of time in Africa, which is the poorest continent in the world. Its population is set to double. But I feel in the countries we're working in, okay, COVID poses very special problems, but the quality of government's getting better, the life of the people's getting better, life expectancy is going up, we're actually getting on top of the killer diseases. And even though the challenges are immense, there is real progress. And you take a step back and look at the arc of the last 30, 40 years, you know, the world's lifted more people out of poverty than ever before in human history. So I'm...
Did you see Jeremy, by the way? Shut up, I'm talking to the Dark Lord. Stop it, you're embarrassing me.
I remain optimistic. I'm just not quite so optimistic as I was about Western democracy right now.
Thank you. I'm just going to exercise chair's privilege, if I may, and give the very final question to my 10-year-old son, John, who just wants to ask a very quick final one. So I'm just going to let John sit in my chair.
Oh, my God.
Hi, John. How are you?
That's Jeremy Hunt's son. Amazing. Amazing. I'll see you to ask him.
Good, thanks.
Nice to see you again.
Do you think the climate crisis will be over by the time I'm your age, or do you think the world is going to end?
I think it's going to be over by the time you're even younger than me, because I'm now quite old. But I think the key to it will be having the ingenuity and creativity to develop the science and technology that allows us to develop sustainably. So I was just talking about Africa a moment ago. If the population doubles.
Tony Blair just said climate change will be over by the time this kid is an adult. It's a little bit surprising, isn't it?
And the people all need to get the same things that we take for granted in the West. So they need electricity and transport and power generation and all the building. We've got to help them do that in a way that's clean and green. And you can only do that if you invent the science and technology to allow us to do so. But we're getting there. You know, we're doing a lot better than we did. You know, before you were born, when I was in the Prime Minister, solar power and wind power were considered pretty weird and not very viable things.
And now they're still not very viable things. Isn't that right, Tone?
And today they're a major part of our energy production. So no, I am.
What was it? 3% or something? Major part, yeah, 3%.
I'm optimistic about this job. You will be younger than me by the time we're on top of this issue.
So creepy, Blair talking to a 10-year-old kid, brainwashed 10-year-old Jeremy. Now bear in mind now, right? Jeremy Hunt's son is literally just a libtard.
Thank you.
Well, Tony, thank you very much indeed. That's been a fascinating discussion on a huge range of things.
I imagine if we watched Blair talking to the young Bruce Lee Hunt there for long enough, he'd start trying to turn him to the dark side, like Palpatine Luke, you know. Take your father's place at my side. Fulfill your destiny.
So on behalf of me, but also on behalf of Chatham House and all our audience today, a very big thank you for your time. To the audience, we will have future interviews, and we're hoping the next one will be with Dr. Henry Kissinger.
Oh, bloody hell, he interviewed... right, yeah. Let's speed run the global elite, shall we? Tony Blair 1 week, Henry Kissinger the next week. Brilliant, Jeremy.
Possibly the Canadian Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, and we'll also have former Foreign Secretary William Hague and David Miliband in the chair, so we hope you'll join us for those. But in the meantime...
You couldn't make this shit up, even if you wanted to. They would joke, these people.
Tony, thank you for a fascinating discussion and some really interesting insights on the big challenges we face. So it's a really weird thing, but if we could just give a virtual clap to Tony, I will say thank you to everyone, and this concludes the session. Thank you all.
Bloody hell. That's what Jeremy Hunt got it, right? In between, what was he, like the health secretary and being the chancellor now, that's what Jeremy Hunt got up to in his, like, 6 months off, interviewing the Dark Lord and bloody Henry Kissinger. When was Jeremy Hunt kicked out of the cabinet before? Let's see if I can find his wiki here. So what are these people? Horrible that we left to live under them. He's had so many jobs as well. He's currently the Chancellor, and he has been since October. Then he was the secretary. He was the Foreign Minister under Theresa May. He replaced Boris Johnson as the Foreign Secretary. And then when Bojo came in, Hunt was kicked out under Bojo and replaced with Dominic Raab. And basically he was in limbo while Bojo was the Prime Minister. But then he was parachuted in when they ousted Truss. So, you know, the regime is fully back in control, fully back in control. So there we are. I don't know, like people like Jeremy Hunt, you know, they talk about like, you know, the liberal meme is like Adolf Eichmann, you know, like I was only following orders type stuff. That's the kind of character that Jeremy Hunt is to me, you know. Anyway, let's hit those super chats before we get out of here. Adam E says, Black History Month. Happy Black History Month. It's always Black History Month. This is that horrible thing they do, because the UK calendar for all this stuff is different from the US one. So it's always either Pride or Black History Month somewhere, you know. Adam E says, who is more powerful, the gay or Tony Blair? It's that meme. They're literally the same person. You know, they're the same. courage, not despair. We need a third way, a third position, if you will. Tony Blair. Yeah. Anarcho Republican says, this super chat is for sponsored analysis of the background painting No Surrender 69 by Ken Howard. So there we go. That was the... It was for sale at Christie's, this painting. Who had that in the back? Was that in Blair's background, was it? What was that all about then? What was the... It was bought for 26 grand in 2008 by Tony Blair. All right. Okay. Well, clearly Blair has that painting now somehow. So there we are. I don't know what it's about though. So is that something to do with Northern Ireland? Is it? Is Lady of Shalott still here? It's the Troubles, right? I mean, clearly Blair thinks he solved the Troubles. That's probably why Blair has this painting. You pay 26 grand for it. So, you know. All right. Courage Not Despair says that Blair gets so animated and giddy when he talks about evil plans he loves. It's quite sweet, actually. Well, I don't know if you notice, it's specifically when he talks about digital ID. That's when he can't help himself. That's when he's like, gets the power grip out. And also when he talks about technology, but I think, honestly, the technology just kind of reminds him of his digital ID, and then he gets a hard-on again. Now Ireland is part, you know, very, very much part of the gay. So, well done, Tone. Another one. JS says, one, I am reminded of the debate in 2020 where a certain Richard Spencer was making basically the same point. I'm reminded of the debate in 2020 where a certain Richard Spencer was making basically the same points as AA is now. When Biden wins, you'll see criminals locked up and the border secured. Yes, but Biden clearly is not thinking in the same way as Blair. And this is something that I've pointed out before. The Biden administration and the US Democrats aren't listening to the Blairs of this world at the moment for reasons. And if you remember, Tony Blair even called Joe Biden an imbecile at one point. So Blair is far to the right, quote unquote, of the Biden administration, where they position themselves. But of course, we know that that administration is not legitimate. And they've made a lot of mistakes, I think. So I still think that ultimately the US regime will do the containment, whether it's with Trump again or with a Democrat. They can't carry on going all out woke because it's just too unpopular. And it's not because of populist delusion reasons why they need it. As I keep on coming back to, it's because they need people to kind of believe in the institutions, right? Because if people stop believing in the institutions, that represents political risk. And it's something that they've talked about at the World Economic Forum before. In fact, somewhere in the Populist Delusion, I quote some woman talking about anti-elite sentiment and things like that. So ultimately, one way or the other, whether they do it through Trump or DeSantis, or whether they do it through a Democrat, they're going to need to bring a large chunk of the public back home, because this situation is untenable. It's not just for like a democracy, for any ruling party. For a dictator, it would be untenable, right? So they've got two ways of going. They can either go like all out Stalin and start being like more coercive and using like force on people, or they can do the Blair thing and play containment. But they have to do what they have to at some point do that. They cannot get away with this situation that they're doing at the moment indefinitely, in my opinion, because essentially what will happen is that an effective counter-elite will form, and that counter-elite is not going to take no for an answer. In America, it's already happening with people like Chris Rufo and DeSantis and various other characters who are basically saying, we're fucking running things now. So how do you like that? They are doing it. I mean, whether we like them or not, they are doing it. And I think that the, you know, people within the regime will see that, and they'll be like, well, we're gonna have to make moves to make sure that this is contained. Otherwise, we'll lose the whole lot to another elite who has more will than us, essentially. JS says, he was like, AA, basing it on the fact that the last time Democrats were in charge, Obama was indeed comparatively harsh on deportations and suppressing riots. However, since then, Democrats realize they can accrue power by courting anarcho-tyranny for very cheap and easy political gain. What if the Labour government goes the same route and turns the entire UK into Birmingham? I mean, it's possible. The thing is that they can do that. It's just a more difficult route. It's a more risky route, right, to be a desperately unpopular elite who needs to like start relying on ever more coercion. Okay. It's a viable strategy if they're prepared to go Stalin. If they're not prepared to go Stalin, then there'll come a point where people will just organize against them, and they'll be prepared to die against them, right? And when they get to that situation, they fucking had it, right? So eventually, they will have to come round and listen to the likes of Blair, who is, from their point of view, the sensible man in the room. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, maybe in 2 years' time, Keir Starmer will be, you know, 10 times worse than our worst nightmares. Right? Maybe that will happen. But also, Biden, right, hasn't really been, like, what radical shit has Biden done? He hasn't turned the USA into like a communist nation. He hasn't really brought in like what really radical stuff has he done? Has he done anything as earth shattering as Obamacare, for example, which was actually under Obama? That's a question to be asked, right? I mean, the worst stuff I think Joe Biden has done is the red speech. That was a terrible speech from the point of view of power being treated as legitimate in the country. Terrible speech, because he basically threatened half the nation. One of the worst speeches ever given by not just a president, by like a political leader of any stripe. Even a dictator giving that speech would be treading on thin ice. The other really bad thing he did was when he kept on coming out and threatening people with F-15s. Again, really stupid. When there's already question marks over your legitimacy, you shouldn't be doing stuff like that. So, I mean, I do think that at the moment, the Biden administration has not acted wisely. They are making like unforced errors here. All they needed to do was be not crazy for a while. In terms of actual hard policy, I don't really know what crazy things they've done. But in terms of the rhetoric, they have basically made the situation worse from the point of view of the regime and power. Because the more Biden talks like that, the more people will be prepared to just give their lives opposing them to form it. What they really want is for people to, like in the ideal scenario, people check out of politics, right? They check out of politics. They're not interested anymore. And go back to watching Netflix, essentially, right? That would be the ideal scenario. Go back to your bread and circuses. Don't worry about all this politics stuff. Don't worry your pretty heads about it. Go back and eat from the pig's trough. And I think in the UK, they're closer to achieving that right now. They've put Corbyn away, and they put the crazy away on the left from Blair's point of view. They've put the crazy away on the right from Blair's point of view. Okay? And now the adults are back in charge. Starmer for Labour and the likes of Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak for the Tories. And people are checking out of UK politics. People are less interested now than they were 2 years ago when Boris was the Prime Minister or when Brexit was a thing. They've checked out. That is much more effective as a ruling strategy than what Biden has been doing, which is pissing everybody off all the time with his stupid rhetoric. You know, so bad is the situation over in America that now, like, parts of the liberal media are, like, openly criticizing Biden all the time because they just can't get away with it anymore. So they have to change tack over there in America if they want to keep that country together. And ultimately, I think power and the regime will come to their senses. Again, I've been, you know, in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, you can go back and say, AA, you were wrong about that. Things have got fucking 100 times worse. In which case, great. In which case, great. Because ultimately, I want the US state to come down, as I've said so many times. But from the point of view of power, the sensible thing to do would be containment, as I've said repeatedly for years at this point. Glow in the Dark says, commitment that Blair sounds about, the commitment that Blair talks about sounds like the old way stocks used to work. People would buy stocks in a ship, and if the ship is destroyed, we are all hurt. But since they all had only a small piece of it, you could survive that financial loss. Added bonus, if all leaders do it, you have no alternative to point to and compare. Yes, that's very true, Glow in the Dark. The original joint stock companies, like the Merchant Adventurers Guild of England and the original East India Company, they all started as joint stock companies in that way to pool risk, essentially. Glow in the Dark says, maybe they remove Saddam. When they removed Saddam, their views were completely ideological. The thought that the people would fight each other or that democracy was beyond them, like how Lenin thought the workers of the world would unite. Maybe they thought if democracy was in place, everything and everyone would be fixed. I somehow doubt that. I mean, that's what they say, but I doubt that's true. These guys, I mean, you've seen how Machiavellian Blair is. He didn't know that if you remove, this is like Thomas Hobbes 101. Don't tell me Blair and friends didn't know that. They did know that. Glow in the Dark says, EV cars and charge stations wouldn't work, AA. Once these cars and charge stations leave safe, elite neighborhoods, the criminals are stripping the copper from them. The more copper price goes up, the more it will happen. It's already happening in the ghettos. 80 kilos in an EV is 15 kilos in charge stations. And the Glow in the Dark says, Biden reinstated Obama regulation that claims all water in America is federal property. Every drop of water is the feds, which is an extreme policy by US standards. Okay, fair enough. That's something he did, I guess. All right. But what I'm saying is he hasn't, like, you know, paid, like, slavery reparations or, you know, done, like, something like Uber Woke, which is the sort of stuff Tony Blair has in mind, you know. Hinsha says AA loves Tony. Master Crafter says, excellent stream. Thank you for everything you've done. Well, thank you very much, Master Crafter. It means so much. Lil Araretta says, in regards to their emergency alert service, what is the concern Alien Man has? We have had that in New Zealand for years. Mainly goes off with severe flood warnings or tsunami evacuation warnings. Well, Lil Araretta, what Alien Man was claiming is that they were going to use the emergency alert service to tell people what's been happening once the White Hats take over, right? That was their whole thing. The White Hat, the Patriots are in control, right? Everything we're seeing is a facade. And any day now, you're going to see Hillary and Biden and all them hauled up and given like a military court-martial. And we're all going to be told about it through the emergency alert service. That's what the Alien Man and friends used to claim, right? But it was all bollocks, and never happened. Surprise, surprise. Middle class English Duma says, "I am calling it now that mixed Chinese will be the future British Prime Minister for the late 2030s, knowing how corrupt and feudal our nation has become." Yeah, what is the name of Jeremy Hunt's son? We should keep tabs on him going forward. You know, he has stared directly into the Dark Lord's eyes and had a one-on-one conversation with him. There's no way that kid is not tainted with evil forever. So we should keep an eye on Hunt Jr. Deplorable Patriarch says, Bruce Lee Hunt, as I called him. Deplorable Patriarch says, given that this was filmed during the pandemic, is that the ghastly sub-Banksy mural on the wall over Blair's home study or personal bunker? Well, I think we saw where it was. It was that Northern Ireland thing that we were talking about. Machiavelli Sucks to Go says, I hate Block History Month. James Carter says, the interview reminded me of Mr. Perfect versus the Red Rooster. Well, that's a hell of a callback. That's a hell of a callback, James Carter. Poor old Red Rooster. Glow in the Dark says, Democrats let governors push woke policy. I mean, I'll say what you want about Terry Taylor. He had a hell of a wrestling mind on him. He was a good creative guy, Terry Taylor, behind the scenes. But, he couldn't make the Red Rooster work. Glow in the Dark says, Democrats let governors push woke policy, then like in California. If it isn't too damaging or if it gives better benefits, the federal Dems pick it up. That's probably true. Swick says, Blair is just selling the tried and true bread and circuses to third world governments to cull the masses. So there we go. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I hope you enjoyed this. I hope Porkins is stewing in a bath of his own sweat, fully deserved. Please join the channel. Maybe you want to pick up a mug, subscribe to the Substack, or pick up a course at the Academic Agency. Only the best courses. Now the book is finished. Maybe at some point I'll have time to write a new one. At some point. But we'll see. I'm taking a bit of a break. Maybe this next month I'm going to put my feet up for a while, play a bit of Mountain Blade, take AAA to endless soft plays and picnics and things like that. And maybe next week I think I'm going to get back on the Substacks. That's why I'm going to try to get out an article a week in February for the Substacks. I'm going to try to start my Myths and Legends series where I'm just going to be reading stories and putting them out as normal videos. So that's going to be my next thing. YouTube want me to make shorts. I had a meeting with a guy from YouTube. Can you believe that? They want me to make shorts. I'm not sure about that. But if I do make shorts, it's not going to be like mobile phone stuff. I will probably do... So remember I had that like 59 theses lecture I gave? I went through 59 points. I thought, well, if I did every single point as a 60-minute thing, it might help kind of onboard some newbies with a couple of, like, you know, with my 59 core theses. Maybe I'll do that if I have time. But really, I just want to do nothing. Really, I just want to, like, sit back with cucumbers in my eyes and play video games, listening to shows that I've missed. I mean, that's the biggest thing I've missed working on my book, is listening to my friends. I haven't listened to any Morgoth. I haven't listened to any Bronze Age Pervert. I haven't listened to anyone, really. I've just been catching up with Scrump and Evelyn's show. They did one called Social Media is Fake and Gay. Brilliant show. Absolutely brilliant show. Yeah, they're on form. I tell you, Scrump and Evelyn, like, they've always been based, but I think they're really on fire at the moment. They're doing, like, I tell you what Scrump and Evelyn are doing that's really good at the moment. They're taking all the theory that we learned, all the theory that I have introduced to people, all the theory that they have read with Sam Francis and stuff, and they're just applying it. They're doing really, really good deep dives at the moment. So if you're not subscribed to Scrump, you should. I don't know if there's any mods in the chat, but if you want to link Scrump's channel in the chat, people should subscribe to it, because they are on fire at the moment, just doing great work. I just like they're thinking in a way that is different, because what they're doing is they're going back to news stories people have forgotten about, and they're linking together things and piecing it together and presenting it for you. To me, that's like 10 out of 10 type stuff that those guys are doing. So I'm planning to binge them. Maybe I'll finally have a few cigars, chill out for a month. And then when I'll get back on it then soon. You know, I've had a lot of sleepless nights, friends. I put up a picture of myself on Twitter earlier on, just to show people how fucking haggard and disheveled I am at the moment. Maybe I'll go and get my beard cut and have my hair cut and buy a new tweed suit or something. Because at the moment, I've been working so hard that I basically look homeless. So, yeah, I'll have a good sleep. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you very much. Yeah, there's Scrump Monkey. If you're watching on the replay, Scrump Monkey, you'll see it in the side chat. Do subscribe to Scrump, because honestly, they're knocking it out of the park. And you know me, I don't give out praise like that lightly. They are really doing top work. They're doing stuff that is not just a rehash of shit I've said. They're doing like original work that I haven't seen anyone else do. Like on that social media one, for example, they're linking like news stories everybody's forgotten from like 2016 election cycle. And they're linking it to stuff that's come out of the Twitter files, and they're linking it to stuff that we've learned since, showing basically how connected the social media, you know, the big tech companies are to the kind of intelligence complex. Really, really amazing stuff. But they've got a lot of other good streams as well, and I'm looking forward to doing a proper catch up with them. Then I'm going to catch up on Morgoth, I think, because I've been seeing Morgoth is getting. I mean, Morgoth always knocks it out of the park, but just, you know, I've been seeing a lot of his recent stuff being hyped as well. So, yes. So that's me. I'll see you next Monday for the Deepest Lore. Thank you for joining me. Most importantly of all, everybody, get out. What goes on in this town?
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.